This is Vital Signs, a podcast on cutting-edge trends in health tech and the people shaping them. And today we have a really fun episode. It's a crossover with my AI podcast, Unsupervised Learning, with Joshua Meyer, the CEO and co-founder of Chai Discovery. Chai is really at the forefront of the AI biospace and building foundation models for improving drug discovery. And so I think folks will really enjoy hearing his perspective on what's happening in the space today and the next milestones that really matter. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jacob. Excited to be here. Long-time listener, so fun to be on the other side.
Well, I've been looking forward to this one for a while. I feel like everybody, from Dario and Anthropic down to, you know, a person you talk to on the street is, you know, I feel like the world is convinced that biology is just this unbelievable use case for AI models and really going to have some of the biggest impact of anything that folks are working on now in terms of just the impact on humanity. And so no better person to come in and educate our listeners on what's happening in the space.
Oh, I'm humbled. Definitely true, though. You know, AI is a perfect tool for biology, and excited to dig into that today.
You know, AI drug discovery, the idea has been around for quite some time, and I'm sure our listeners are familiar with some of the proper nouns in the space, like Recursion, you know, one of the early kind of startup successes in this world, and AlphaFold, and some of the interesting breakthroughs that happened on the DeepMind side. I think to start, it would just be helpful to contextualize for our listeners. What has this like journey been like over the last decade in AI drug discovery? And maybe bring us to like where we are today.
A lot has happened over the past decade. I think if we look about 10 years ago, so 2015, you know, deep learning had just started working on GPUs. I think the AlexNet paper was like 2012. And I myself kind of got started building neural nets in 2013. Very different time. You know, the tooling was not in a great place. Things were not moving as fast as they were today. But 2015, I think, was really the time when you started to see the first deep learning models being applied for protein structure prediction and protein design. It's actually my co-founder, Mac McPartland, built some of the first deep learning based models for protein folding.
And at that level of compute, could they do anything?
Well, actually, it turns out you could do a lot. So this is a funny thing too. You look at some of the recent models like GPT and BERT, you know, like what language modeling. What's a language model? It's like kind of predicting the next word in a sentence, or the way people did it a few years ago was mask out a word and try to predict what's there.
Right.
The biologists have actually been doing this for like two decades. This is how people used to do protein folding pre-deep learning. You would take like a sequence you're trying to predict the structure of. You'd find a bunch of similar sequences and you'd look for some patterns. And it turns out the math that they were using is basically the same math we use in language models today.
Well, I thought healthcare was always like 20 years behind everything else. It's good to hear that we're ahead on something.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the biologists essentially discovered language models way before we did. This interlink between AI and biology is actually quite strong.
Yeah, and so I guess you had these early models on like limited amounts of compute, and then maybe talk through, obviously there was kind of this first wave of tech bio funding and some folks that got started there. What worked in that era? What didn't work?
Yeah. So if we look at the first, that was more on the research side, right? So yeah. Thinking about how AI was used for protein folding. If we now look on the commercial side, like startups and companies that were getting started, there's been a couple of like starts to this space, right? So maybe the wave one tech bios were companies that were trying to just create, like focus on data, right? Everyone used to say the problem with like AI and biology is the data. We're going to go produce a bunch of data. And actually that is correct for some problems. So you mentioned Recursion, for example. They did some really interesting stuff on what we call phenotypic screening. So what they would do is throw a bunch of random molecules at some cells, take pictures of them, and then use neural networks to try to understand right. What's going on. So this is a bit of like, let's boil the ocean, try a bunch of molecules, and have a neural network filter out what works on top. The second wave of companies, I think, was trying to do stuff that's closer to what we're doing at Chai today, but you know, with much weaker compute and models. But it was like, let's actually try to model the molecules themselves. So you saw this wave of AI small molecule companies, especially, that were trying to predict various properties of molecules and use that to design better ones. And one of the challenges there is like, that actually makes a lot of sense. And it's sort of what we're doing today, but no one really knew where the technology was going to go. So it was, I think, the right bet in terms of like, this actually is a perfect problem for AI. But many of those companies were started like pre-GPT-3, right? Actually, even pre-GPT-1 in many cases. So you're doing this without like the latest and greatest machine learning technology today. And now you have what I guess I like to call the wave three companies, of which Chai is a part of. So the companies that have started in the last couple of years, you know, post the big like AI craze, actually being able to borrow a lot of those lessons from NLP and computer vision and video generation, and then using that to actually build models that are really working and working with incredible reliability. Like you see with our latest tools at Chai, you know, success rates that are like 10, 20% plus. You know, you choose 10 molecules, you're actually going to get a couple that are even working on your first try.
I think it would be helpful maybe just to contextualize like the state of the union today. I mean, obviously people talk about, oh, you know, we're excited for AI models to be designing personalized cancer therapeutics for, you know, for everyone in some short order. Maybe just help us understand what actually works today. Like what have we proven with some of these newer models? And then what's, you know, what are the milestones still on the come that are that will be exciting when we get there?
So biotech's a really broad space. It might even be worth just like backing up into the different components, right? You've got 100%. Target discovery. Like let's figure out what we want to make a drug against. Drug discovery. So let's take that target, discover a drug against it. And then we've got to go put those drugs into clinical trials. And there's been a lot of work around trying to do clinical trial optimization.
Right.
So I think there's really amazing AI work happening at the forefront in each of those areas. Maybe let's start backwards. You know, in the clinical trial space, you have companies that are using LLMs, you know, the same ChatGPT style stuff to write regulatory documents faster. There's a ton of paperwork that goes into this. It's actually kind of funny. You see folks like the FDA now saying that they're going to be using AI to actually read some of these documents.
Of course, AI on each sides.
Exactly. Yeah. So AI is going to be like judging the documents. And then, of course, now the pharma company is like, let's use AI to write the documents. So it's kind of funny. We'll have AI talking to AI right now. I hope that ends well. But that's like what I think the frontier in the clinical trial space. And I think that that's super exciting because it's just like, let's take these efficiency improvements and try to move faster. There's a lot of bureaucracy and also rightfully so, something that you do have to regulate. You're putting a drug into a patient. We want to make sure we're doing that carefully. But there's been a lot that's kind of been built up over time there, that can slow things down. So an area of AI, super excited by like, you know, the clinical trial optimization. And I think the folks that will probably have major impact there are the ones that are building on top of, you know, the OpenAIs and Anthropics of the world.
So obviously then I think across, you know, target discovery, you know, finding the actual compound you want and then optimizing that compound, maybe talk a little bit about, you know, where we are today.
So that's the area where we're playing at Chai. So we're looking at drug discovery. So this is where we take a therapeutic hypothesis, maybe that's been figured out in, you know, the lab over the past 10 years. You have some idea, if I go and make a drug against GLP-1R, maybe that will be useful for diabetes or for metabolic disorders or for weight loss. And the question is, how do I actually get the best drug possible for the patient? And that's the problem that we're focusing on at Chai. And I think it's also a perfect problem for AI as well. And the reason for that is at the end of the day, when you think about what a drug is, it's a set of atoms that are organized in a certain way and either some synthesis process to put those atoms in those form, or just like a DNA sequence that encodes a protein that kind of comes up with that form. So if we can actually learn how those atoms are interacting, again, on that fundamental level, on an atomic scale, we can use that to go in and invent life-saving drugs.
Can you walk us through the sequencing? So like, obviously you had AlphaFold, which, you know, was really around like structural prediction, right? And you're kind of like, you know, taking this a step further and going from not only structural prediction, but actually to de novo design. And so, you know, and obviously it feels like that's happening across the field. What was actually required to make that transition from, you know, the AlphaFold breakthrough to some of the stuff we're seeing today?
Yeah. So if we look at AlphaFold, amazing breakthrough, I think 2021, AlphaFold 2 I'm referring to, actually. I think AlphaFold 1 was even before that, 2018. What those models were doing is you would take a single sequence, a protein sequence, and then try to predict what the 3D structure looks like. That's actually incredibly useful for basic biology. I can take some sequence that I'm studying, something I find in the lab, and now I can figure out what that 3D structure looks like. That's a process that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to actually do. These days, it's actually even come down. Maybe let's call it like $30,000 to kind of get a 3D structure. But if you can take 100 million proteins and go predict the structures, right? Like you're talking billions of dollars worth of research that's basically can be done. I don't want to say overnight. There's a lot of compute that goes into it. But, you know, running your GPUs for a couple of months, you can really start to predict the whole protein universe. And what's happened since then, so the past 2 years or so, let's call it, is we've graduated from predicting the structure of single proteins to predicting the structure of entire macromolecular complexes, which means how does a protein interact with another protein? Or how does a protein interact with a small molecule or small molecule drug? How do DNA and RNA interact with those things as well? And that's been becoming transformative now for drug discovery, because drug discovery is not just about understanding a certain protein. That can be useful for our underlying biology knowledge. But as we start to move into design, right, your question, how do we go from protein folding into design? With design, we're not trying to just change an existing protein. We're trying to invent a new molecule that will perturb or modulate the existing molecule. And this breakthrough of being able to actually predict how these things interact with one another is immensely useful then for actually going and designing those things as well. It's almost like we've now built atomic level microscopes. And under in the Petri dish, under that atomic level microscope, we're designing these atomic level drugs that can actually modulate those proteins in a certain way. And that's the breakthroughs that, now we're moving into 2025 and beyond.
There's different, modalities of therapeutics that people create. And like, I'm sure these models work better for some than others, or, talk a little bit about, the various challenges involved in each of the different types of therapeutics.
There's two main classes of therapeutics these days, antibody molecules and small molecules. There's also other ones as well. There's gene therapies you might be reading about in the news. People are building things based on CRISPR. But the biggest classes by far are, again, antibodies or biologics more broadly. It's a protein. It's created by biologists, what we call it that. And then small molecules, which is really chemistry. So going in and synthesizing those molecules. And as a result, that's also been the main area where a lot of the AI bio action is happening today, just because today, at least, you've got like the biggest markets around those.
I think traditionally, like if you look at a pharma company, they're really good at one of these modalities, or they have a whole team that's like spent their whole lives in that. Obviously, one of the powers in the general, foundation model space is when these models generalize really well. How have you and other folks thought about, hey, are we building models that are really good at one of these types of drugs versus, the ability to, hey, you know bio, it can generalize across the board?
Yeah, it's funny because you're starting to see a transition now. It used to be people would segment these companies into, I'm an AI small molecule company, or I'm an AI antibody company, or I'm doing AI for gene editors. But really, the models are modality agnostic. Let's take these models that understand things at the atomic level, right? We have a model that we started with Chi-1, which is all atom model, right? And it can predict all these different modalities. People were calling it multimodal, but at the end of the day, it kind of is like, I guess it is multimodal. You're placing atoms, you're also understanding sequences, but these models, they take an input and they give an output, and they don't really care whether it's a small molecule or it's a protein or something like that. There is a question about maybe where you're focused your data generation efforts, but they're even potentially transfer across these domains. You might have some data on small molecules that helps you get better data for your antibody. So I think you might still see some of these commercial focuses just because the manufacturing process is different. Maybe if you decide to partner with biopharma, the teams you're working with might be different. So there still might be some focus. At Chai, we've been really focused on antibodies so far. But I think long term, the models work across the stack. So there's really no reason why on the AI level, the models need to do one thing or the other. It's kind of like even for LLMs, like if OpenAI is good at doing text, should they also be able to do video? I mean, it is a slightly different model, but it's the same AI researchers you can usually build across those different domains.
Well, it's been interesting to see too, right? I feel like in the general model space, it felt like for a while, this generalization thing was completely true. And it's like, you get better at any set of tasks and it made you better in aggregate at everything else. And now it feels like maybe we're moving, you have the latest Anthropic models and they're like unbelievably better at coding. And it's not clear they're that much better at other things as well. Like, does it feel like as a space, folks are seeing these signs of generalization across today? Or do you think we're in an era of, hey, let's go really deep on a specific space?
So again, I think just on the base model level, especially if you're just training things on, let's say, publicly available data sets, like we did with our first open source model, Chi-1, the models, like, again, you train, it makes sense to train on more data and bring together these different modalities. So we haven't seen necessarily that the models are much better in one domain than another. Maybe one example of this is, like, turns out that predicting the structures of DNA and RNA is a little bit harder than predicting how proteins and small molecules interact.
Yeah. Why is that?
Yeah, so that might be a data problem where there is much more data on the 3D structures of proteins interacting versus like protein and DNA. But I mean, that can change, right? You can build new data sets around these things. I don't know if there's like a fundamental reason why one should be harder than another. There could be, right? Like, maybe one of these things is very dynamic, and it turns out that we struggle to get dynamic data in the lab around these things. So there could be fundamental reasons why one is harder than another. But I think the story is actually still being written around that today.
Well, I mean, you kind of alluded to this and when you were talking about the first wave of AI bio, you mentioned so much of it was around, generating data in labs and really innovative ways to kind of examine and interpret that data. I feel like, a lot as people think about the opportunity for AI in biology, material sciences, these other spaces, a big question is around this loop of kind of running experiments in the real world and feeding that back into models. And, a lot of companies are thinking how to get really good at this. How have you thought about the role that data generation plays and then also building that loop of kind of real world experiments into kind of the core models?
AI models need data. So You always need to be thinking about
that. We don't have the whole internet in biology, do we?
Well, actually, it turns out there is a lot of data available. I think if you just count the number of like even DNA base pairs that are just available on the internet, you know, you've got like double digit petabytes of information to train on, right? And that's actually getting more than what we even train some of these language models on. So I actually don't know if it's like the volume of data that's the problem. I think it could be the quality or the diversity of data that could be problematic. So it depends what problem you're trying to solve. Actually, one really interesting thing to consider there is the role of like pre-training versus post-training. So in the LLM space, right, you pre-train on all this data that's available on the internet. But the early models, like let's go back to like GPT-3, GPT-3.5, those models hallucinated a lot. Part of the reason there is like these models are trained on Reddit, for example, for question answering, right? And on Reddit, nobody answers with, I don't know. Like that's just not really a valid answer.
You surely don't get upvoted if you do.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's true too. Yeah, good point. So if you put in a question on some of the early language models, it would never answer, I don't know, if it doesn't know the answer, right? It would just like start hallucinating something because it's like, yeah, if you have a question, you should give some kind of answer. The latest models have gotten a lot better there. And part of this is the post-training recipes. So really interfacing with the models and saying, you can just imagine what happens there. Like you have multiple users who are building training data, like talking to the LLM. The LLM, you know, has a question and then you rank the answer. If it gives an incorrect answer versus saying, says, I don't know, you know, I don't know is better than the incorrect answer. So you start to build this post-training data. You start with your base model and you build on top of it. And I think biology actually has a very similar analog where in pre-training, there's all this data that's like available on the internet, a lot of like academic studies. Think about where that data is coming from. There's this great paper I love. I think it's from New York University where they actually go and swab the New York City subway system and go and sequence all of these bugs that they're finding. And there's a lot of really interesting data that's created there. I think that really helps the models understand what makes a protein a protein, but it doesn't tell the model like what makes a protein a drug, right? That's a kind of data set where you're not gonna find in the New York City subway system. If you wanna understand what makes a protein a drug, there's probably other kinds of data sets that you need to start building. And that starts to get you closer to like the post-training world. Coming back to the question about like where data sets arise, I think you just wanna just ask like, what is the problem you're trying to solve? I think we should be really ambitious and really hopeful and optimistic about what those baseline data sets can do. Like we should think really hard about what the, you know, those bugs, bacteria on the subway are teaching us, because if there's a, you know, an answer that can be a question that can be answered from that data set, don't go and like reinvent the wheel and build up your own data set. Like don't build data for the sake of like having the biggest data set. Build data in places where like the data just doesn't exist or the models are not performing well. So I think that's why you're seeing now with the latest wave of companies, much more of an algorithmic focus. Let's be driven by the models. Let's not just have our view of what data is needed. Let's start with the models, see what they can do, and then build up the data sets we need in order to make them better.
Yeah. Do you think the future of this looks like, I mean, obviously one very large pre-trained powerful model with like specific post-trains for, like what is the level of specificity by which you would post-train for, you think, in the future version of these models?
It's a great question. I don't know if I have the answer yet. If we look at what has happened in LLMs, I think the jury is still out there as well, right? You have maybe most people using or building on top of like a baseline LLM, right? A GPT-4 or soon a GPT-5. But companies will still take these models and try to fine tune them for their specific applications. So the question, how long fine tuning lasts? There's less and less fine tuning happening as the base models become more powerful. I think the same thing will happen in biology as well. But to this post-training point, you might have a pharmaceutical company, for example, that has a lot of data related to a certain class of molecules that they like working on. And they might have the most data around that in the world. And it might make sense, therefore, to take one of the base, you know, let's say protein design models and then fine tune that on the data that they've generated in-house or find a way to, you know, prompt the model with that kind of data they've generated. So I guess I don't know the answer to the question yet, but I think it's quite possible that you do end up with, you know, post-trained versions of these models in these different organizations. But it really depends how far we'll be able to get with the base models.
So how does that impact how you think about your focus, right? Because you've obviously built these incredible models. And I feel like given that, what you just talked about, there's tons of different things you could do with them, right? You could just keep building a really powerful base model. And there's tons of things that people can build with those base models long-term. You could, you know, build the powerful base models and partner with companies to, you know, that have their own data sets and help them kind of do post-training or fine-tune these models. Or you yourself could find some, you know, like, hey, like this is an interesting end market. We could build up a bunch of data and fine tune and post train for that. Not that these are all mutually exclusive. How do you think about allocating resources across some of these different approaches?
Well, you're exactly right. They're not mutually exclusive, and it really makes sense to be building across the board there. I think one thing I've learned in my career is not to bet against progress in AI. And that means we should probably continue to bet on the base models getting even better and build a strategy around that. But at the same time, I've also learned that you need to be pragmatic and you need to solve problems. And if you can solve a problem today, you probably should. So if there's a certain data set that's out there and you know requires post-training a model on it, and maybe it's not as elegant as like a single base model to roll tomorrow, if you can go and use that and you can now create a really meaningful drug that can get to patients, like I think you almost have like a social obligation to do that. So they're not mutually exclusive. And I think it really makes sense to be building around all those strategies.
Totally. I feel like this tension exists in like anyone building something that's actually being applied in the AI world, where there's always this feeling that like, yeah, could you go to a beach and wait 5 years for AI model progress and you probably get it for free long term? Maybe. But in the meantime, like there's so much you learn from actually, you know, deploying these things. And in your case, bringing a drug to market 5 years sooner is a pretty powerful moral imperative. So I guess on the data generation side, how have you thought about like, you know, there's tons of people that raise money and build big wet labs and like actually, you know, do all these experiments in-house. There's a really great network of folks to partner for, you know, these days to get data. And then you can also just get, you know, raw data sets themselves. How have you thought about like wanting to have data generation efforts in-house?
Yeah, so we've really been driven by the models in this regard, right? And figure out what data do the models actually need. It turns out that a lot of the data sets that these models need can be built with somewhat commoditized methods, right? So especially if we look at antibody engineering, post-COVID, there was a lot of capacity that kind of got built up throughout the industry. And a lot of that capacity is actually underutilized right now. And we've been able to leverage it at Chai. So if you look at the Chai 2 report that we put out, we actually partnered with multiple different labs on the studies there. Part of that was also just like the credibility and just like trusting our results. You know, you can test something in your in-house lab, but it's also really good if you can have external parties that can validate what you've done. And then moreover, if we just think about the elastic capacity here, we were able to like really focus on building various versions of the model. And then, you know, when the new checkpoint is ready, you can go send a lot of capacity out there throughout the ecosystem. So I think that it makes a lot of sense to tap into the resources that are out there and to partner, you know, when possible. There was a trend in a couple of years ago where people really wanted everything in-house. It was almost like a cool thing to do to have like the most people you can attract to your company and the biggest lab that you can get. And I think these days it's almost cool to do the opposite, right? Like keep the leanest team possible, really maintain that kind of focus and figure out just what you need. So I think if we just play this out over the next couple of years, it probably ends up being a mix, right? If there's data sets or there's methodologies that are commoditized and you can build on top of other folks, probably makes sense to do that. If there's something that's more unique, maybe there's a certain disease model that you create, or maybe there's a certain really smart data generation strategy that you come up with. Those are probably the kind of things that you'll build in-house. So we're not really dogmatic about either of these. We're just driven by like, what does the model need? And let's figure out the most pragmatic way to get that data.
Totally. Well, speaking of the models, I mean, you made this really interesting decision to open source some of the model work. And I guess like, was that something from day one you knew you wanted to do? Or talk about like what led up to that and kind of how you think about the role of open source in the company?
Yeah, great question. So we've really talked about two main models at Chai. We have Chai 1, which we released open source late last year, and then Chai 2, which we just announced a couple weeks ago. And if you look at Chai 1, we open sourced that, right? So this was the model. Chai 1, at a high level, is the atomic level microscope. So predict how atoms interact at the atomic level. And then Chai 2 is a model for actually being able to design those molecules, right? So you have your atomic level microscope. Now let's actually, you know, move things around like under that microscope. For Chai 1, we actually expected that models at that capability level would become open source anyway. So we decided that like we would be the ones to do it. We really just needed Chai 1 for what we were building next with Chai 2. You know, if you can't really, you don't have the microscope, it's much harder to go and build the design tools on top of it. So that's why we started by building the microscope. We really made a bet when we started the company that the protein-protein interaction stuff was gonna get a lot better. If you just look when we started the company, I think the state of the art methods at the time, they would only predict high accuracy antibody antigen complexes. So antibodies are about half of the drugs that are being developed these days. And only about like 10% of those interactions were predicted with high accuracy.
So you mentioned Chai 1 is this like atomic level microscope. And that's obviously something that you put out in open source and it's been used in all sorts of cool ways that folks should check out on Twitter and online. And then you know, more recently you released Chai 2, which is really around molecule design. Talk a little bit about that, about the breakthroughs, some of the results you published.
Chai 2 is basically Photoshop for molecules. So it's a system where you can put in a prompt. We have a target protein that we'd like to make a molecule against in a certain site and maybe some other properties about the underlying molecule. And that comes out a set of molecules that we go and build and test in the lab. And really the breakthrough at Chai 2 was not even just like setting up that whole prompting system, but it was just the success rates that we saw in the lab. 1 in 5 of the molecules that we tested actually bound to the target as we expected.
And that was like really surprising for you, right? I mean, your initial expectation was quite a bit lower.
Yeah, well, our target for the year was to get to a 1% success rate because that would be transformative for the field.
Nice, right? Then we can just go test OKRs by 20 times.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it just says a lot for the field. Like, what's going to happen now that we can just be building molecules on the computer and just expect them to work in the lab? We didn't believe the results for weeks when they came out. This is actually one of the reasons we did this across 50 different targets. Most people doing these AI biology projects test like 1 to 5 projects. And we did 10 times more just because we couldn't believe it. And we did a bunch of follow-up experiments to really characterize that the molecules behaved as expected. And nowadays, it's almost like suspended disbelief. We have these crazy ideas that we're working on at Chai these days. And I used to just like not believe that they would work, but now we just like expect it to work, right? It just changes the way that you work on things. If you can design it, it'll probably work in the lab, which is just like a pretty crazy way to be doing drug discovery.
Did you like see a piece of data that, was it a leap of faith or did you see a piece of data or something that, obviously you were on the inside of this before, like what gave you the confidence that was about to change?
It's a bit of both. You're always taking a leap of faith in science, but that leap of faith is hopefully grounded in data. So we did see signs of life that this was going to be possible. And part of that was just seeing results on the design side. So the models were getting more robust design. So if we started to design even just like a part of a protein, for example, if you just look at the literature and designing parts of an antibody, not designing like the full drug, but just like optimizing existing drug, we saw the success rates going up over time, which we felt was an indicator of the models becoming more accurate. And then the structure prediction side, there was actually a little bit less work. It's been interesting about the structure prediction foundation models as they've been actually more discrete. They've been like big leaps in terms of the quality that are out there. And what we realized is that you start with like looking at single proteins, like with AlphaFold 1 and AlphaFold 2. AlphaFold Multimer took this to predicting like multiple like a complex of molecules, how do two proteins interact with one another? And we realized that you could extend beyond that as well. So why can't you bring in small molecules and DNA and RNA? So we started to see that just on the capability side. And the last thing I want to mention is just like the progress we saw on the machine learning side. So the previous gen, like the AlphaFolds of the world, where they looked a lot more like the older image generation models. You would put in some sequence, you would basically get out a single structure, but diffusion models were coming online. And we thought that that was going to be really important for getting the best quality structure prediction methods. Because at the end of the day, like you have some ensemble of hypotheses, at least we thought the model would have that. And if the model was unsure about what the protein structure should look like, it would just choose like one form or the other form. But with a diffusion model, instead of kind of collapsing to the mean there and like averaging what the guesses are, it could just sample different guesses. And then you could have another model that pulls out the best guess. So we saw diffusion models coming online and we felt that that could be a big driver of stronger performance for these methods.
That's fascinating. It's like in previous generations of models, you it's one answer. So you just kind of like compress a lot of different ideas to kind of an average of everything that maybe is therefore not a super interesting hypothesis. Whereas with diffusion models, you're able to generate a ton of different ideas. And it's actually in that brainstorm space and all these new ideas, you can then have other models evaluate whether those are good ideas. But the most interesting part is like, of those many new ideas, some of them probably make no sense biologically, and some of them actually are quite novel. And the ability to distinctly generate a bunch of them is really unique.
Right. So diffusion models are very good fit for biology.
Totally. I mean, I assume that's how traditional drug hunting also works in many ways. Lots of trial and error.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny too, because if you just think about the early days of like protein folding and structure prediction, people were using these like energy-based models. There's this long, rich history of this tool called Rosetta, started in David Baker's lab. And Rosetta is basically an energy model. It's like a bunch of terms that describe the energy of a protein. That's sort of what a protein folding model is doing now too, with like diffusion models. They're sort of like, this is deep connection again. Like I called out earlier, the language models and like the way people used to do protein folding back in the day, like in a sequence-based way, statistical-based way. Then there was like the physics-based way of doing things, like coming up with these energy-based models. Yeah. And that's actually very similar to what we see with diffusion models nowadays too. So again, very deep link between the old days, I mean, old, like 20 years ago, way of understanding proteins and like what's now been rediscovered by the machine learning community.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, I think one of the cool parts of having the open source model, right, is you get all these folks using it. And I think you've publicly talked about some of the cool ways. But I love, like, what are your some of the favorite or like most counterintuitive or things you wouldn't have expected ways that you've seen people use the open source model now that's been out in the wild?
Well, the models, I think, reason about things different than we do. The design models like that we've done with Chai-Chu most recently, I think that's even crazier to think about because you're giving the model a prompt and then it's coming up with some answer. The open source model, right? So it's a little bit easier to think about because again, it's like a microscope, right? So things might be surprising if you had the wrong hypothesis, but when you're designing things, the models just come up with these solutions that, I mean, you look at the map, you're like, this is just so creative. And they just think differently than you know, the chemists and the biologists do. And you look at these solutions the model's coming up with, you're like, they're like, this is a good idea, but like, will this actually work? And you go test it in the lab and we find out 2 weeks later, like it worked. And it's just crazy when that happens. And there's these days, like just the, I think the, you know, the intensity and energy level of the company has just been going up over time because we just see these wild things that the models are coming up with. And then you go test them in the lab and they work.
Does it feel like we've already had this like AlphaGo move 37 moment of in bio today?
Well, I think so. That's what the solutions that these models are coming up with, right? Like we just prompt them in a pretty natural way. Like, I want you to make a molecule that causes like XYZ function to, you know, to this protein. And, you know, the models are not really even reasoning through the biology themselves. We're more translating a therapeutic hypothesis into a prompt. And then the model is like solving that, like with here's some sequence that you should go make in the lab. And then it ends up playing out. So maybe that's like the Move 37 style thing, right? Like the model's just coming up with those creative solutions. But like the creativity is not what matters at the end of the day. What matters is, can you solve problems that were just not possible to solve before? Or can you make the processes way more efficient, you know, by orders of magnitude than what was possible before?
And it sounds like in a lot of these, you're taking a therapeutic hypothesis that exists that some people have like speculated about, and, you know, you're obviously testing, you're finding ways to test that hypothesis and really good ways to basically, if that hypothesis were true, you know, you've had the perfect, you know, molecule or compound to test that. What about like the hypothesis generation itself? Like, are you messing around with that at all? Are people thinking about that at all? Or is this kind of, given the model capabilities today, the right level or the right place in the drug discovery process for us to be applying these models?
No, that's exactly, I think, the right way to think about this. So in biology, actually validation can be a lot easier than generation. And I don't mean like clinical trials, right? Like if you want to validate in a human, that can actually be a lot harder. But if we just think about like in the lab or even in an animal, validation is much easier than generation, than finding something, right? Because how do you generate something in the drug discovery world, like pre-AI? There's a reason why we call it drug discovery. What you'll usually do is take a bunch of random molecules, literally billions of molecules, and try to find one that has the function that you're looking for. That is a very slow process. It's actually a very inefficient process, and it is not always a very successful process, right? Because billions might sound like a lot, but the search base here is like there's more possible protein molecules than there are even atoms in the universe. So just trying a billion random ones, like most of them are just going to be duds. If you can now have an AI model that owns that generation process, and then we can go straight to now, you know, characterization in the lab and like the verification is a lot easier. So now that generation has become easier as well, the new bottleneck becomes like your ideas and your biology. But the cool thing now is you can start to brute force a lot of those hypotheses quite quickly as well. So, you know, at Chai, like it's almost crazy. Like sometimes people are like, how did you decide to try this idea versus this other idea? And we're often just like trying like tons of them in the lab because it's just easy enough to do it right now. So don't spend too much time like being a perfectionist. Just go try your 10 biological hypotheses and just brute force it now in the lab and see which one works. So there's this question that people often would ask us, are we going to see more lab experiments or fewer lab experiments going forward? Or is it going to stay the same? You might've thought that with AI, there'll be fewer lab experiments, but I think that just spit out
the answer. It's like, this is the cancer I'm trying to attack. They're like, this is the molecule. Now go do this.
Well, I'm saying we don't even have to be at that point, right? The models don't have to understand the biology. We can just move that capacity in the lab over to just brute forcing a bunch of different biological hypotheses. And I think ultimately this will allow us to do more creative biology and come up with better drugs and go after things that were undruggable, things that were just, you know, really intractable to do with existing methods. we can now just like try a bunch of ideas and try to find much better medicines than we were ever able to discover before.
So how should people think about using Chai 2? Like, I mean, is this something that should be a part of almost every product at this point, or are there particular areas where you're like, hey, if you're working with a problem with X contours, it's a really good fit for that?
Yeah, well, so Chai 2 is specifically focused on protein and molecule design. So things like antibodies, about half of the drugs that folks are working on right now. And I'd recommend, if you're working on an antibody project, you should come talk to us and figure out if Chai 2 can accelerate that work. I think there's both the easy projects, so things that you're pretty confident that you would be able to design the drug today. But let's speed up that process. Like, why not do it with AI? It might actually allow you to go and explore better versions of the drugs than you would have been able to discover before. And then the second area, which I'm even more excited by, is let's use Chai 2 to go in and solve problems that were just intractable before. You know, there's companies that have spent years trying to discover a drug to address some therapeutic hypothesis, and they just can't find something. But with Chai 2, we might be able to discover it at the click of a button. So I think those are the two no-brainer areas where Chai 2 should be used today.
I'm curious, like, there's these like legendary, you know, drug hunters of the past that have like had, you know, managed to have multiple hits and I feel like are in industry lore. Like, you know, and obviously they had a very specific skill set. I'm curious if you could just riff on a little bit, like, there's clearly going to be some set of other legendary, like AI-driven, you know, drug hunters in the future. To what extent are those skill sets going to be similar? Like, what, you know, what do they look different? Like, as we write the biographies of those people 20 years from now, curious what you think on that.
Yeah, well, I think actually drug hunters can will be really important in this story now, right? Because if we can now, again, brute force through those kinds of scientific hypotheses really quickly, now people who can be creative about what problem we're trying to solve can actually become quite valuable as well. So we'll see what happens as the models continue to improve, right? Like, we're being surprised every day. I think that even like the general purpose LLMs, I think, are actually becoming quite good at coming up with biological and scientific hypotheses. But the folks who can now build on these models and then use them to solve really meaningful tasks, I think have a lot to gain.
In preparing for this, you know, I listened to your co-founder Jack on another AI podcast, and one thing he was talking about, which I found interesting, was just like the importance of being a product company and not just having the models, but a product on top. And obviously, this is something we've seen in OpenAI and Anthropic and other folks in the kind of foundation model space, you know, building product on top. Can you say a little bit more about that and how you're thinking about, you know, building the product area out and like what it will look like in the future for a researcher to use a Chai model?
Yeah, we think really carefully about product at Chai. And what product really means to us, like when we think of ourselves as a product company, it ultimately means we're trying to solve a real problem. We're not just building models for the sake of building models or because they're cool or because we think AI should be used in biology. At the end of the day, like if we don't need AI and it turns out that just like, you know, plain old software is like what you need to solve these problems, like amazing, right? Like, doesn't matter to us if it's AI or it's physics-based methods or something else. We ultimately just want to articulate the problems that exist today and then go and build solutions to those. And that's really what we mean by product at the end of the day. It's not even like you need a fancy web app or you need to have something that's like particularly sticky. It's just like, what does it mean to build a product? It's working backwards from the problem. Even in the drug discovery world, a product might, usually people by products, they mean like a drug that gets marketed at the end of the day, because that's a product that a patient is taking. And in our case, maybe it's Chai looks like a product that a drug hunter is using to make a drug. So it's really working backwards from the problem. And that is core to our DNA. And that's what really the whole team is always thinking about, is how do we solve this problem, and being really open-minded to whatever solution we need in order to find the answer.
Zooming out, obviously you're part of this wave of like, there's, you know, just a ton of excitement and funding pouring into this kind of like, you know, foundation model for biospace today. And I'm wondering, you know, for our listeners, if you could just kind of articulate how you think about the landscape and maybe some of the differences in approaches across, you know, some of the big players like Isomorphic and Profluent, Evolutionary Scales, Iro, and kind of, you know, where you kind of fit Chai into this broader landscape.
This wave, we kind of articulated the different waves of AI biotechs, right? There was like the wave one and the wave two. And I think ultimately like the wave three is probably going to be the most successful, right? And become the enduring companies, in part because the technology is really working today. I think you can kind of segment the landscape into like the approaches that people are taking, and then B, into the way that companies are like monetizing the advancements that they're building. I think if we look at drug discovery, like, just think about how the industry works. the revenue of the whole industry is ultimately, like, the big bucks are generated in having an approved marketed drug, right? Patients are buying a drug, and a single drug product can make billions of dollars a year. Some of the biggest ones are double digit billions a year even. And I think you got to think about that and work backwards from there. And you could either go for that long shot, try to fully own your drug. You could partner on developing those drugs with other folks, or you can build the kind of tooling to make it easier for other folks to kind of find those as well. And I think that's sort of how the landscape gets segmented. But at the same time, I also think we're very early in terms of how things are unfolding. Ultimately, it's still at the end of the day, you know, there's the whole system of how payers kind of end up paying for those drugs and where that revenue ends up going. But along the way, you know, if you can really accelerate the process, things can really start to change. So I think it's going to be really exciting just to see how the landscape evolves. And I honestly think it's really hard to even talk about each of these players, because I think everyone is kind of taking this as it goes, because the technology is moving so quickly. I think the business landscape is probably going to move a little bit slower than the technology, but I think ultimately it'll probably start to change as well. So it's going to be really exciting to see how the next couple of years unfold.
I feel like people look at, like, the kind of history of folks building for, you know, pharma over the last 10, 20 years. The common trope would be, hey, look, to really capture the value here, like, you've got to be a therapeutics company. Like, ultimately, you're never really going to get anything remotely resembling those economics without taking an asset kind of end to end. You know, obviously, it seems like the industry is in for a big change. Wondering how you're thinking about, like, how you can capture some of the value that clearly is going to be from these models, you know, without kind of taking therapeutics end to end.
Yeah, well, again, I think people have actually, most biotech companies technically don't take therapeutics end to end. Most of them exit way before a drug gets approved.
Right, with assets, though, that, like, other people are valuing on taking end to end.
Yeah, the point is that the value in this space is creating a drug, right? And you need to have some way to really demonstrate that you are increasing the odds of having that drug approved. Are you opening up new kinds of drugs that can be created? Like, just ultimately, if the value is being generated in assets, you need some way to kind of inflect that. And that could be, like, bringing a drug to phase one and then selling it, right? Like, that's one way. Obviously, now I've got some drug that has it's much lower risk than some idea I wrote down on a piece of paper, right? I've de-risked it, and then now I've created some value, and people might buy that essentially data package and IP, in some cases for billions of dollars already. So I think you just have to work backwards from there. But I think what's going to be different this time around is that the kind of the previous approaches in this space just really haven't worked well enough yet. Like, imagine trying to build a business around GPT-2. You can do it, and people tried. It just didn't work as well as, like, the current wave of AI companies that are building, because the technology is just working a lot better. So imagine trying to be, like, a partner to pharma on GPT-2 or something like that, or on an AI technology that's not actually competitive with the methods that they already have. Like, some folks would buy it, some would try it out. Would they really come back to you for more? I'm not really sure. So I think a lot of these assumptions that people have about the space might start to change. But I think the story is being written now. I think we're going to see clearly folks are taking this seriously because the models are really starting to work. And I'm really excited to see you know, if and how the industry changes around that.
What are, like, the milestones that matter in this space going forward? Like, if you could say to our listeners, like, hey, if you read this in the news, like, that means the space has really had some sort of, like, step change. How should people be thinking about when, you know, what to be looking out for?
If you asked me this a couple of months ago, then I would say, especially for, like, antibody generation, can we get models that don't require us to do the high throughput screening in the lab? Because, right? When you do the high throughput screening, things are just not scalable. You can't ship, like, a high throughput screening process to hundreds of drug programs that are being done in the industry. What you can ship across the industry and what you can do in a scalable way, or, like, AI models, right, or software. So the big bet that we had this year at Chai was being able to create AI models that could design antibody drugs with an accuracy or a success rate higher than 1%. Because if you had, like, 1% was really the mark that we were going for, because if you could do that, then you could just start to brute force, you know, those ideas, right? If your success rate is, like, 0.01% or 0.1%, if you're talking about screening thousands, tens of thousands, millions, you need to build some fancy thing in the lab to do that, or use some fancy thing that's been discovered elsewhere, right? Not as scalable. But if you can get to that 1% success rate, and now you can start to brute force your ideas, the way that you discover drugs can really start to change. So that was, I think, what we want to be looking for. We want to be moving the discovery process from the lab into the computer. And the crazy thing is that's, like, now happening, right? Like, with Chai 2, we announced that we can actually design these things with a success rate way higher than 1%. We have, like, a 20% success rate in the lab. And now the molecules that are coming out of Chai 2, they definitely need more work before, you know, we'd feel comfortable putting them into a patient. The molecules aren't perfect, but now we can move from, you know, those success rates into, can the model be, you know, listening to our hypotheses in a more accurate way? Can it be coming up with more sophisticated hypotheses? So I think we should really be measuring how much is happening on the computer, because ultimately that's way more scalable. It also compounds on itself, because as the models get better, if we think about data generation now, let's actually use the model to generate data, or let's use the model to enumerate hypotheses and kind of bring that back into the models. So I think that's really the thing to be looking at, is how much is being done on the computer, and then how is this actually going to compound, and like really understanding that to kind of predict what the rate of progress is going to look like.
Obviously, I think, you know, a common thing people talk about is, oh, the day the first AI design drug is approved, like that'll be this like insane milestone. Any like interim milestones in between here and there that you also are like, hey, these are important as well?
I think it's less important to me to think about like what the first AI design drug is like. There arguably are AI design drugs that are in the clinic, or you might even argue approved. There's approved therapies that use like computation as part of the process, right? So, I mean, is that AI or is it software? I mean, I'm not sure it really matters. I think the bigger question is, can we actually deliver immediate value? Can we go and use these technologies to create drugs that were not possible to be discovered before? I think that's really the thing to be looking at. And maybe that's even the right answer to your previous question. Like, how do you measure the rate of progress? What I was saying before is maybe how like a technologist should look at this to kind of think about like what's happening next with the AI models. But if you think about this from like a pharma perspective or a life sciences investor perspective, right? How is the industry going to change? I think it's more about like, are we solving new problems that weren't solvable before? That's ultimately how you start to see like the market growing, right?
Is it possible that like we get to models that are actually like, you know, the future we've always dreamed of, but because it takes 5-10 years for, you know, to go through full trials and to really know whether these drugs work in humans, that like we may get there and then, you know, a decade later realize we got there, I guess. What is the length of time that it takes to, you know, to realize that?
Well, you need to have metrics that don't require you getting all the way through clinical trials, because the feedback loop is frankly just too slow. And then this has been one of the problems as well. Like one of the reasons why progress is moving so much faster now is when more of the design happens on the computer, instead of waiting months in the lab to figure out whether your thing works. If I go design 100,000 antibodies, it's going to take me like, you know, weeks to months to figure out whether those designs were successful. If I only have to test 20 because my model's so good, I can find out in 2 weeks. So it's really important to have tight feedback loops if you're going to make progress. And that's why I think we need to be translating, you know, ultimately, let's say some mechanism we want to achieve in a human, we need to figure out a good way to measure that in the lab so that we can get the right feedback loops going.
It's interesting. I feel like sometimes I'll like there's so much excitement about these models, and sometimes I'll talk to someone in the traditional bio world, and maybe they'll throw a little cold water on it, be like, well, look, you know, you can find things that bind to drug, that, you know, bind to targets. That's cool, but like, you know, let me know when they've run a full battery of studies and it's equal or better than something else that we've generated before. I guess I'm curious, like, what do you think's fair about some of the critiques from folks who may be a little more skeptical about this, and what maybe do they get wrong about what's happening in the space today?
I think that's totally fair. First of all, right? If someone discovered a drug and then you just discover that same drug again, but you used AI, like, why does that matter? Well, how does that actually change the game, right? That's why I think what we really should be shooting for with these methods is just up leveling the kinds of molecules that can be made. So take antibodies, for example. With Chai 2, we've shown that you can take a specific site on a target and then go generate an antibody that binds that. But imagine if we can now go beyond that and we can say, well, since it's now so much easier to discover those molecules, what if we actually make molecules to several parts of the target and then stitch them all together? That's something that we might call, the field calls, a bipartite topic, for example. They're much more difficult to discover in the lab. But now if it becomes a lot easier to discover them, I think you might see an increase in those kinds of molecules that are being created. So I think just like up-leveling the kinds of therapeutics that we go after is like the right thing to focus on. The other thing too is like the critique about, oh, do these molecules look like the same molecules that I would discover the traditional approach? Like that's actually getting resolved, I think, much faster than we would have thought, but it's still not going to generate that kind of impact. I think what people want to see is like, how does this actually change the game for like what I'm looking at? Like I'm a life science investor or I'm a pharma company. I want to acquire a drug. Are you creating a drug that like just wasn't, you know, possible to be discovered before? Those are really, I think, the things to be focused on. Or can we make better drugs that just weren't possible before?
It feels like we're going to move to a future where these models are, you know, ubiquitous in drug development and really change many things about how drugs are developed, the, you know, difficulty, but the specificity of that. And I'm wondering then the ripple effects for what that has for the broader pharma industry, and how, you know, what it means to be a really successful pharma company, which today I think is, you know, mostly acquiring early stage IP and then being really good at running it through trials and sales and marketing. Maybe that stays the same, or maybe the ecosystem has new players that are needed or evolves in some way. I'm sure you've thought about this before. What do you think the evolution looks like?
So it's a matter of timeline, first of all. So again, if we look at the spectrum from like where we are, let's call it 2 months ago, right, pre some of the recent advancements. And then we also projected out a couple of years, like imagine it would be possible to build what we think about as Chai as zero shot drug candidates. Like your first pass out of your model, you actually, maybe it doesn't have to be 100% success rate, but within the first batch of molecules you get, one of those is the one you're actually going to put into a clinical trial. You know, now the question becomes like, what is your therapeutic idea? Many people will have that idea and they can kind of translate that into molecules. So I think ultimately like patients win here, right? Because they get better molecules. I do think pharma wins here as well, because if we think about them as capital allocators who are acquiring a lot of the drugs that are out there or working on them their own, pharma these days about like 2/3 in licensed drugs and acquisitions and about 1/3 like internal pipeline. But I think they start to win just by being able to create better medicines. I think it's really interesting to think about what happens with biotech. You know, how do you create like a competitive advantage here if it's now much easier to discover molecules? So you might actually see, you could see this going in two directions. You could see pharma actually doing a lot more discovery because it's become easier. Like, do we really need biotech anymore to be innovating on the discovery, or are AI models doing it? So do we just go partner with like an AI company to make this happen? Or you might see the opposite. You might see that it becomes way easier to discover drugs. So pharma's like, hey, like we don't want to touch this. Let's just let all these guys kind of like discover the molecule, test in the lab, we'll buy it from them. So you can really see it heading in either direction. I think regardless, it's probably not going to be like night and day here. There's probably going to be some balance. I think you'll probably still have a healthy ecosystem of biotech and pharma kind of deploying these methods. So I think change management is going to be really hard in these organizations as well. So I'm not as convinced that, you know, throwing a model over the wall is going to work here. It kind of goes back to like the more product mindset.
I'm not sure that really works in any industry, maybe besides selling to developers or something.
Yeah, but even there, right? Like developers also, like throwing some tech over the wall, like you want to get those continued updates and you want to have something where you can kind of orchestrate all the tools that are coming in. So I think people, again, what's even harder now in biotech is you're not selling to developers. You're also selling to an industry where these tools have not worked for a long time. And also where things just haven't changed that much. Like the actual discovery process has not changed that much in the past, like 20, 30 years. Totally. It's very different in tech, right? Tech people are used to the waves. There was mobile and now there's been AI, and like people are just used to change and they really adopt that. And biopharma hasn't always worked that way. But at the same time, I think people are just going to look at the data and they're going to say, hey, like, Pfizer got access to this like really good AI tech by working with a company like Chai. How can we not get access to that, right? Like imagine if you're the one pharma that doesn't have access to this kind of tech, you're going to fall behind. So I think we will see kind of this like slow progression at the start, and then it's going to like rapidly start to expand, because once a couple of folks like show that this can really make a difference in the bottom line, other folks are just going to have to like hop into it as well.
Totally. I mean, it would be crazy not to use it. I mean, obviously, like you said, there has been maybe, you know, some false starts in the past in some of these spaces. You know, when you're coming in and kind of pitching, hey, this time's different, is there like a killer slide, or like, is it mostly demoing on their own data, or like, what's like the one killer thing you do that people realize, oh yeah, like this really is different?
Yeah, I think the killer thing is hard challenges. So show examples. There are these canonical examples that have been really hard for people to design before. And I think whenever you can show data around those, it can be very compelling. So that's like the number one thing. If someone has worked on a project for 5 years and then your AI model does it in 2 weeks, that's pretty cool, right? There's one example I think of. There's a company that spent like $5, $10 million like working on a project. And then we prompted the AI model with, you know, that therapeutic hypothesis, and we got to the answer within like 2 weeks. Yeah, just to answer your question, like what is getting people excited? It is showing them problems that they couldn't do before, or things where, you know, if they spent 6 months to a year trying to discover an antibody and we did it in 2 weeks, that's, again, it's another thing that's pretty mind-blowing.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. We always like to end our interviews with a quick fire round. And so maybe to begin, what's one thing that's overhyped and one thing that's underhyped in the AI bio world today?
Underhyped, I think, would be discovery of molecules. This is working really well now and people should be paying attention. I think what is overhyped would be, you know, AI design molecule in the clinic or something like that. It doesn't actually matter at the end of the day whether the molecule came from AI. What matters is, like, is this industry actually going to improve? Can we get better drugs to patients?
I assume you take a lot of lessons from other parts of the AI world. What, like, other areas of research outside of bio are most relevant to the work you're doing and you kind of pay most attention to?
You know, what we're doing is very interdisciplinary. So, of course, all the stuff on LLMs, video modeling, you know, proteins can be dynamic, and then even physics, just really understanding how atoms interact at the end of the day. It gets down to the underlying physics and chemistry.
Yeah. So there's the famous, I guess, Irem's law, which is Moore's law reverse, which is, you know, how much less efficient we have at, you know, at discovering and making advances in on the biotech side. Do you think that reverses in the next 5 years?
I hope so. That's the goal here.
Yeah. If you were a betting person now, you think more likely or less likely that in 5 years we're able to stem the tide there?
Maybe that's also, I should add, as like an overhyped thing. It's not just probability of success that matters. It's like, what is the value that you are generating? If you take a drug if you just make a copycat drug, there's already a therapy there and it doesn't really change the standard of care. It doesn't matter as much if the probability of success is high. So I actually think we want to be ambitious. We want to be taking risky projects. The industry needs to be taking more risk, not less risk right now. So probability of success, like Arum's law, it's kind of like the wrong thing to look at. I think what we need to be looking at is like standard of care for patients, like work backwards from there.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm sure there's all sorts of threads people want to pull on. I want to leave the final word to you. Where can folks go to learn more about you, about Chai? Anywhere you want to point people, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, check out our website, chaidiscovery.com. We've got a couple links there to some of the breakthroughs that we've worked on. We've got a video and a technical report about our recent breakthrough, Chai 2. You can go to our GitHub repo and you can find the open source model, Chai 1. Reach out to us if you're excited about what we're doing.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much. That was a ton of fun.
Thanks for having me, Jacob.